This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, Julian Ng and myself, Sharad Kutin, with the top business stories of the day. And we're going to start with Uber. Its revenues continue to grow after leaving China, where it was in a looked like a fight to the death.
Didi Kwaiti. Otherwise known as Didi. You can just call it
Oh, just call Didi. Okay, Didi. I can do Didi.
Otherwise, that ride-sharing app in China.
It's the only.
There are many more. They're the dominant one.
All right, so they're Uber Alles. Losses do not include the Chinese operations. So the losses in the third quarter are put at 800 million. An astronomical, colossal loss. But apparently, it's not affecting enthusiasm for Uber.
Somewhat.
I mean, it is. It's taking China, is it?
We've had a lot of people piling in a lot of money to Uber, making it a super unicorn. I mean, a unicorn is a startup that is valued at about $1 billion. And this valuation is brought about by the new money getting into the company with an implied valuation that's represented by that new money. So the most recent one I think we saw, Co-op, our local civil service pension fund, plowing in about 120 over million ringgit into Uber. So the question is, with this kind of losses, I mean, this is the biggest losses by any tech company ever. I mean, they made about 2 billion losses last year, and this year they're slated to make about $3 billion in losses. How does this affect the kind of valuations by companies or by investors that have got in early? I mean, for a company like Co-op, for instance, they would want to think of what the valuation in Uber is, whether they could have a form of exit through an IPO. Is this going to delay the listing of Uber? And worse still, I think there are some valuations out there. Right now, the implied valuation of Uber is about $70 billion, but there are some valuations out there which say that this is a kind of extremely overvalued. Certain valuations put it at, for example, a New York University professor puts the Uber valuation at just under $30 billion, so more than half of the existing valuations.
Right. I'm very interested in this valuations story because we had, of course, that attempt. And I'm kind of forgetting the name of the Malaysian company. I was trying to buy a British company. And what they did was they sold one of their operations or an arm.
MP Evans.
That's right. So the KLK MP Evans story is quite interesting because there, MP Evans is saying, well, we're actually valued more. And KLK says, no, I'm going to buy you for much less. And then MP Evans goes out and sells some part of itself, proving the valuation. Right? So I thought that was very interesting because, okay, so valuation implied by people buying into a company, but also companies proving that they're worth their whatever weight in gold by actually selling parts of their business.
Sometimes you got to put your money where your mouth is. And if you sell and are able to... You see, valuations are not confirmed until you're able to sell something, right? I know of many relatives who want to sell their homes at X million ringgit. And they can never find a buyer for that X million ringgit, right? So, and that means two things. Either your price is too high or there are no buyers out there. If you lower the value of your home, perhaps you might be able to find a buyer. Yeah. And the moment you sell it, that becomes the market valuation. Yeah. So with Uber, I guess, and with all these other tech companies, the way they are valued is very, very different from, let's say, how you value a plantation company. Or even a property as well.
Yeah, because one of the things that people do to establish the value is to say, well, the bank values it at this price and is willing to give me a loan.
You see, but the bank puts their money where their mouths are because they extend a loan to you based on their own valuation. So they're actually putting money behind that. So that is legit, I think. But for a lot of these tech companies, I don't know whether it's legit, because a lot of the valuation is not based on profits, as the Uber case would show. They're making huge amounts of losses, and yet people are queuing up to give them money. So tech companies are valued on something that's very different. I think most of it is valued on a dream or a hope.
Well, is that irrational? Should that be the basis for an investment?
There are people who are experts at doing this kind of thing. So who knows?
Okay. Can we extend the discussion on Uber? Did their failure to beat Didi in China prove that this is something they're going to encounter wherever they go in the world? There could be local competitors who actually have something extra that Uber as a global player does not have.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot to be said about local nuances. I think when Grab first started, they also had that kind of localized offerings. But of course, Grab today is a regional company going into companies around the region. But for China, that's a different animal altogether because of the cultural differences there, of how close the economy is and of how bloody that fight was, because China matches the US in terms of scale. It's not Malaysia, it's not Singapore, it's not Vietnam, right? Mm-hmm. China is another continent altogether. So that gave Uber a good run for their money. So I think there are certain differences over there in China.
Okay. Coming back home, according to the Randstad report, Malaysian employees are more downbeat about the economy compared to their counterparts in Singapore and Hong Kong. I mean, Singapore and Hong Kong are both also extremely exposed to global trends and ups and downs. What, as Malaysia is, I mean, what would be the difference, do you think, Julian, between the two?
Well, first of all, the numbers are very telling. 70% majority, the majority of Malaysians are pessimistic about the economy next year, and this compares to only 60% in Singapore and 63% in Hong Kong, while the global average is 49%. So why are we so pessimistic? That's the question.
Yeah, and because we've had survey upon surveys, we have experts coming out in the last couple of weeks. We've had economists, as well known as Jomo K. Sundram, coming out to say, well, you know, part of the story in Malaysia is a kind of loss of confidence in the government. And, you know, I think coming from a beating we've had over the last year, that global story of 1MDB, right? And so shaking confidence in good governance of the country, not just of its coffers, but of, you know, in its stewardship of the economy. So I think that's a big story, and that's been said over and over again.
That's right.
And I think perhaps the falling ringgit has also made it very painful for a lot of middle-class Malaysians, deepening the pessimism, because the falling ringgit, maybe it's about the cost of living, but it's also about aspirations in it, Julian. I mean, you want to send your kids overseas for an education that you think will give them a head start in life, and that's the one thing that's going to be so affected by the depreciation in the ringgit. So really, you know, cutting at the heart of middle-class dreams in Malaysia.
Yeah, I think even the local education is going to be so much more expensive as well. But there is something to be said about the notion of how policy affects our sentiment, which we don't see in some of these other more developed economies. I mean, we are super extra pessimistic here compared to jurisdictions like Hong Kong or Singapore. Perhaps they have a little bit more hope there in the ability of the government to turn the nation around. Singapore has been known to be quite formidable in their economic management. So perhaps we go back to this idea of buying hope again, right? Like Uber and all these other tech companies buying into hope. Perhaps the Singaporeans are slightly more willing to buy hope than us Malaysians. But globally, it's only 49% pessimism. So this could be explained by certain safety margins, social safety nets that are available in some of the more advanced economies. If you're out of job, the government gives you a dole or something so that you can cover monthly expenses.
Yeah. There's also what we read in the front pages every morning, right? I mean, what is the big story in Malaysia's, in push in legislation in the last year? It's been the Hudud Bill, right? I mean, how confident can you, in sense of what your sense of what the future will bring? I mean, is this a country, sliding towards that alternative vision of Malaysia that maybe a lot of middle-class Malaysians don't buy into, with restrictions on their personal freedoms, with more moral policing? There's a whole range of things that are implied by this kind of legislation.
Do you think that the people who support Hudud, will they be more positive about the Malaysian economy?
I don't know. I mean, maybe. I mean, if you're a member of PAS, especially because that's been one of the planks of PAS for so many decades, maybe they see finally they will get what they dreamed of, and maybe they will be happier.
Yeah.
So that's one possible explanation. I think it's one of those explanations that needs so many different factors feed into the deep pessimism of Malaysians.
Yeah, and I also think that the Edge survey asking Malaysians how the economy can be fixed is also quite interesting, because chief among the demands would be to fix the ringgit. And you see some other demands to provide more subsidies, to provide more price fixings for essential goods. And because today we have news that Lei Hong, which is that egg and poultry producer, wants to increase prices. And of course, this comes under those kind of
products.
Control items? I don't know whether they're still controlled, but there's certainly sensitive items, right? And it would attract the attention of the government to place more focus if you see runaway prices in these products. But the thing is that I don't think it's as simple as just the government coming out to fix prices or provide more subsidies for this, because I don't think from an economic viewpoint, those kind of policies would work, because you need for seamless production, you need for supply bottlenecks to be taken out of the economy. I think over the longer term, what we really need to fix is, we go back to the idea of confidence, and we need to fix our long-term income earning potential so that we can afford price increases, because everything is related, isn't it?
Yeah.
Prices go up, our income goes up, and then we can afford stuff.
Yeah. Well, I my concern especially with the increase in price of eggs is a lot of people eggs are kind of a cheap source of protein for a lot of people, and if that ceases to be cheap for people, then what are they going to be taking in for protein? And I wonder about, especially for the working class and for people on the lower end of that, whether we'll be seeing a rise in malnutrition for kids
who
come from working class families. I mean, today there was on Twitter a story of a man who was caught for stealing groceries for his children, so that kind of pressure on the working class. We might see increase in crime as well. A lot of things come out of the present pressures on daily living. Julian, we're going to be coming up to the opening numbers of the stock market and more analysis very soon. We're going to have the news coming up. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.